This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Welcome. I'm Dr. Susan Blank. This is Detailing Addiction on America's Web Radio. Today I'm broadcasting from the Atlanta Healing Center and would like to invite all of our listeners to check out our new website for both the Atlanta Healing Center and the Atlanta Wellness Center by going to www.atlantahealingcenter.com. Today's show, I hope, will be a little more hopeful than I think some of our shows have been in the past. We have often focused on the difficulties, the dangers, the risks, and sometimes the consequences of drug and alcohol use. Today I'd like to focus a little bit more on some hopeful information about new treatments that are being developed, new ways of looking at and thinking about the disease, and new ways of helping patients cope. This came to my mind as I was looking at a report that had come out in Alcoholism Treatment Quarterly. This report was written by researcher Isaac L. Williams, and he was talking about some of the difficulties that we've seen with considering the disease of addiction as an episode of treatment that the patient would graduate from and then move on back into their regular life. When we look at the recurrence of treatment rates, we understand that about 64% of Americans who are currently in treatment for addiction are repeat patients. In other words, these are patients that have been in treatment before and for a variety of reasons have not been successful and are now coming back to have further treatment and care. And in this article, Isaac Williams questions whether or not we should be having addiction graduation ceremonies. So for those of you who are not familiar with this idea, let me tell you a little bit about what happens in an addiction treatment center. Normally, and I have to say that we at the Atlanta Healing Center have not been doing this since we have opened, but in a regular addiction treatment center, a patient is entered for a program. That is a designated 30-day treatment program, 90-day treatment program. The patient is entered into a program, and when the patient completes those number of days on a calendar, then they are able to participate in what they call a graduation ceremony or a commencement ceremony that's very moving, very touching. Often the patient has invited their family and loved ones, friends to come and attend. The person has talked about in terms of their progress that they've made in treatment. The patient often will thank family, friends, staff members, and so forth, give congratulations and express gratitude for the opportunity to be in the treatment center. So this sounds wonderful. What possibly could be a problem with this? Well, as our CEO and clinical director, David Donaldson, has said for a number of years, unfortunately, though this is very traditional and very appealing emotionally, the problem is that it sets this expectation, both on the part of the patient and on the part of the family, and honestly on the part of the staff, that this person has now gained all of the insight, all of the understanding, coping skills, and has now the rest of their life to live clean and sober. This expectation that they have completed the treatment and that treatment is no longer necessary is not really in keeping with the idea that addiction is a chronic illness. You don't graduate from diabetes school to go off and live the rest of your life never having to think about insulin or your diet or exercise or taking your blood sugar. You don't graduate from COPD school. You don't graduate from kidney failure school. You are constantly aware at some level, and hopefully at a minor level, that you have this disease and that it impacts the way you have to live your life. So this idea of having a graduation or commencement ceremony really does give a very mixed message to the individual and their family that now everything's fixed. And I mentioned that the staff sometimes has this same attitude, even though most people who work in this industry understand this is a disease and that relapse is part of it. We want to think that we have done our best work, and because of our best work, this person is going to go forth and not have any problems in the future. Again, not realistic. This also sometimes is an incentive for patients to just go through the motions, to check off the days on the calendar, do the minimal amount of attending groups or participating in the therapy part of the program, and not really grasping the concepts and embracing the idea of what recovery will mean to them, not really accepting the idea that this is only a first step in the process and not the last step. We see that many treatment centers, very good ones, but are unfortunately trapped in this idea that there is this program of care, and so you as a patient come and fit to our program. And if you spend enough time here and complete certain requirements, then you are done and graduated, rather than, as we like to look at things at the Atlanta Healing Center, more of a patient-focused care. We ask patients to make an initial commitment to us, but we are able to modify their treatment plan based on their progress towards very specific goals of learning to function, specific goals in terms of treatment of co-occurring disorders, and specific goals in terms of reacquainting with relationships and being able to function in their everyday life. That may take a patient many weeks. Other folks who have had previous exposure to recovery may be able to have a more step-down program, a less intensive program. That is individualized for them. It's not based on any particular time frame, but rather on goals of improvement that the patient will experience. Each week at the Atlanta Healing Center, a patient will come in and we will give them their individual schedule for that week. They may be recommended to have certain, if you will, doses of treatment. For example, someone may be committed based on interaction with me as the doctor, their therapist, care manager, other members of the treatment team. They make a commitment that three times a week for group would be helpful to them, once a week for individual, once a week for neurofeedback, which we're going to talk about in a minute, once a week for individual therapy and the family program. Now, this week I may need to travel, so I need to get my three doses in out of an array of seven different time slots or programs for our groups. So we have seven groups to choose from. That person needs to attend three of those. And they may have to have a different three this week than they had last week or that they'll have next week based on their real life and trying to adapt their recovery to their life and their schedule as opposed to a program being forced on them and they are trying to negotiate someone else's expectations and programming. So this whole idea, and I'm so glad that Isaac Williams raised this issue, because I think it really is a very different way. It seems not so different, actually. Well, we just won't have graduation. But the reality is, this is a different mindset. This is a way of accepting. This is a chronic illness. We hope that patients will go forth, continue their aftercare programs, continue their addiction help checkups throughout the rest of their life, and that they may not need a higher level of care ever again, but they're always going to need to be involved with their recovery team to some degree or another, and they're always going to need to understand this is a long-term recovery plan, and that the person really needs their support network to understand, and the support network includes their family, their loved ones, the people that they interact with on a daily basis, that this is an illness, this is a brain disease, and they are going to need additional support, not just attendance at a graduation. So that got me thinking about, well, what are some of the other ways that more traditional treatment might have changed over the years? One of the things that we're beginning to appreciate and understand to a much greater degree than we ever did before, and that's that sex matters when it comes to addiction treatment. And really, I probably have should have said that as gender matters, but I thought that sex matters gets you a little more of attention, and maybe you'll listen a little more carefully to the next segment. But Yale School of Medicine did a very interesting study looking at the differences between men and women and how their brains respond to either stressful situations or situations in which they are given visual triggers for their drug of choice. So what they did was they looked at people who were cocaine dependent. So they had men and women who were each dependent on cocaine. They had the person come in and describe to the researcher, Mark Protenza, who is the first author of this study, professor of psychiatry and neurobiology, he and his researchers would ask them questions about their use of the drug cocaine, would ask them how they used it, what method, did they snort it, did they smoke it, did they inject it, different information around the ritual of the drug use. Then they would also ask them to describe some stressful situations that had occurred to them and that that may have preceded a relapse. They put these individuals into a functional MRI machine, and during the course of their MRI, they were shown pictures of drug paraphernalia, people using cocaine, people using cocaine in the method that they had used it before. And then they also showed them or talked to them about their stress-related events. We're going to take a break now. When we come back, I'll share with you the surprising results of this study.
The disease of addiction is a life-altering challenge, not just for the person suffering its effects, but also for the family and friends who support and love the one caught in its grasp. What should be the course of treatment? Who is the best person to render treatment? And what is the best place to go for the care that is needed? We know that you want answers to these and many more questions. Call 770-696-9862 and speak to a representative of the Atlanta Healing Center. They can tailor a program specifically designed to address the needs of the person suffering with an addiction or give you guidance as to where that help may be found. Information is the key, and the trained staff at AHC is here to assist. If you wish, you can also get more information on the website located at www.atlantahealingcenter.com.
Did you miss a show that you really wanted to hear? All of our programs are available for download on AmericasWebRadio.com and on iTunes. You can listen to your favorite programs on AmericasWebRadio.com anytime you like.
Perhaps you are struggling to cope with the disease of addiction. If not, you probably know a family member or friend that needs help in battling the cravings and the personal and professional damage done by the effects of drugs or alcohol. Get a pen and paper and be ready to write down the following. These are the issues that the trained staff at the Atlanta Healing Center address and treat every day. Their doctors and counselors with over 40 years of practice in the field of addiction can treat the suffering individual in a thoughtful, compassionate, and experienced manner and guide him or her along the path to recovery. So call 770-696-9862 and speak to a knowledgeable staff member about how you or your loved one can be helped to enjoy a better and healthier life. More information is also available on the website at www.atlantahealingcenter.com.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Welcome back. I'm Dr. Susan Blank. This is Detailing Addiction. Thanks so much for listening. Right before the break, I was talking to you about a study that was done at Yale University School of Medicine by Dr. Mark Protenza and his group there. They were looking at cocaine-addicted individuals. They had 30 individuals, men and women, and they compared them against 36 controlled subjects who were recreational drinkers. So these individuals were asked about their drug-related cues. They were asked about stressful situations that had affected them personally. And they were asked then to get into the MRI scan. And while they were there, they were imaged, of course, and they were given information about their use of cocaine, their use of alcohol. They were given information and shown pictures of people actively using cocaine, using alcohol. And then they were also, through the microphone system, they were given a description of the stressful event that they had reported in as much detail as the person could give them. Afterwards, they found some very interesting things when they compared the MRIs of the folks who had cocaine use compared to the social drinkers. But then when they teased it out even more and looked at the difference between the men and the women cocaine users, they found some very distinct and very powerful differences. So when they looked at social drinkers, they weren't particular. Their reward center of their brain did not light up for cocaine, minimally for alcohol, because they really weren't alcoholics and they could drink socially, but it wasn't a part of their everyday use, and they certainly didn't meet any criteria for abuse or addiction. When they showed the pictures of the paraphernalia and people using cocaine to men, the reward center of their brain lit up like a Christmas tree for men. It was all over the place, very intense, just from looking at pictures of cocaine or people using cocaine. When they looked at the women's brains, however, they really lit up only minimally when they were shown pictures of the use of cocaine. However, the exact opposite occurred when they looked at the brains of women who were described their stressful situation. During the stressful situation, the women's reward center and their amygdala and hippocampus lit up like a Christmas tree. They were very much triggered for the desire to use cocaine in relationship to the stressful situation. On the other hand, men had only minimal increased activity in those regions of the brain. And this was really very specific and very significant, the differences. So we understand from this that women are much more likely to be triggered to crave and therefore at increased risk of relapse if they are in stressful situations. Men are more likely to relapse if they're exposed to the people, places, and things related to their drug use. So the pictures of cocaine, the pictures of the needle or the someone inhaling a line of cocaine, that got their trigger, their desire for and their craving for cocaine to go much higher. Now, if you look at traditional treatment for addiction, remember that the 12-step program was developed back in the 1930s by primarily men, older, upper-middle-class white men, and they talk a lot in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and in the 12 steps and 12 traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous. They talk a lot about avoiding people who you use drugs with, the places where you use drugs with, and the things, the actual alcohol in this case. Those things have been modified for Narcotics Anonymous, but the same idea here. This really is a treatment plan, if you will be much more successful for men than it will be for women, because women don't seem to be as triggered to use again by reminders of use. So their people, places, and things are less of a risk for them. And if we think about what men normally, and again, not normally, but generally, men generally use drugs and alcohol, at least in the beginning, to enhance a situation. I'm out playing golf. This is a great time. Let's make it a greater time. I'm at a party. We're having fun. Let's use a little something-something to have an even better time. Women, yes, if it's there in front of them, they may be at risk for using, but women generally use to medicate feelings, feelings of sadness, of loneliness, of anger, of frustration, anxiety. Generally, women are more likely to use not to enhance a situation, but to be able to just tolerate a situation. And women are less at risk to be exposed to the situations and the places where they've used drugs. Not that that can't play a role, but again, the idea, though, that for women, they really need more help with stress reduction. They need more help with support networks. They may need more help with treating anxiety disorders or depression. They may need to improve their social skills. They may need to get out of dangerous situations and relationships. So the treatment plan for men and women may need to be significantly different. Many treatment centers now are specializing in gender-specific treatment, trying to use this data and other data to understand that one size doesn't fit all. We certainly need to have patient-centered treatment based on their unique set of circumstances, problems, their unique challenges, as well as their unique genetics and epigenetic exposure. But we may need to consider the type of treatment that we're offering people. We may need to really consider that women may benefit more from learning how to cope with negative emotions, learning how to self-soothe in a way that doesn't have to include using substances or addictive behaviors. So this whole paradigm around how we treat men and women is beginning to shift, and we're beginning to understand that to help people be more successful in their recovery efforts, we need to be more specific in what we are teaching them, how we are explaining to them what their disease is and what some of their risk factors are. And we also may need to be more cognizant of the fact that different things are going to be more dangerous for some women than they are for some men. So I think this is one of the very helpful things. Again, the idea of let's treat this as a chronic illness, as we talked about in the first segment, and let's treat men and women in a different way. And of course, inherent in all of this is that we need to really focus on the individual. One size fits all, one program does not work. You need to be able to have flexibility both with what you offer the patients, how you assess and treatment plan for the patients, and you may need to use different modalities of treatment to provide their best chance of being healthy and happy. Now, the next thing I'd like to talk about raised quite a bit of discussion, shall I say, on several of the listservs when the Partnership for Drug-Free Kids came out with the statement from the FDA that sobriety does not have to be the main goal of alcoholism treatments. Now, we have for some time been working in this country with the assumption that the only way for someone to be healthy and to be considered in recovery is for them to be free of all mood and mind-altering substances. Now, the caveat to that has been one of the thorns in my side, which is the acceptance generally of we'll take away your cocaine, we'll take away your alcohol, we'll take away your pornography, but we're going to let you smoke. So, again, another just highlight of the idea that nicotine dependence needs to be treated along with everything else. But the idea that abstinence is the only goal of recovery and the only measurement of successful recovery, I think, is beginning to be challenged. For me, in my early training, the idea of complete abstinence from all substances was very much my mode of treatment. Then heroin came, and the regular use of heroin became much more common and much more deadly among our young people. So the idea of medication-assisted treatment or medication-assisted recovery is gaining more momentum because while you can have disastrous consequences if you relapse to alcohol, you may have problems certainly if you relapse to cocaine, but relapsing to heroin for many of our patients is a death sentence. Many people die who have been in treatment or abstinent for a period of time and then go out and use again. We're seeing huge numbers of people dying from heroin overdoses. We're going to take a break now. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about medication-assisted recovery and other new ways in which we can address the disease of addiction. I'm Dr. Susan Blank. Thanks for listening.
Perhaps you are struggling to cope with the disease of addiction. If not, you probably know a family member or friend that needs help in battling the cravings and the personal and professional damage done by the effects of drugs or alcohol. Get a pen and paper and be ready to write down the following. These are the issues that the trained staff at the Atlanta Healing Center address and treat every day. Their doctors and counselors with over 40 years of practice in the field of addiction can treat the suffering individual in a thoughtful, compassionate, and experienced manner and guide him or her along the path to recovery. So call 770-696-9862 and speak to a knowledgeable staff member about how you or your loved one can be helped to enjoy a better and healthier life. More information is also available on the website at www.atlantahealingcenter.com.
This is Tracy Pearson with Prissy Tomboy. Listen to the Prissy Tomboy radio show every Tuesday at 5 p.m. Eastern Time as I interview special guests that will inspire adventure and fitness for females.
The disease of addiction is a life-altering challenge, not just for the person suffering its effects, but also for the family and friends who support and love the one caught in its grasp. What should be the course of treatment? Who is the best person to render treatment? And what is the best place to go for the care that is needed? We know that you want answers to these and many more questions. Call 770-696-9862 and speak to a representative of the Atlanta Healing Center. They can tailor a program specifically designed to address the needs of the person suffering with an addiction or give you guidance as to where that help may be found. Information is the key, and the trained staff at AHC is here to assist. If you wish, you can also get more information on the website located at www.atlantahealingcenter.com.
This is americaswebradio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Welcome back. This is Dr. Susan Blank, and this is Detailing Addiction. We're talking today about some changes and some, I think, improvements in the treatment of addiction. Before the break, we were talking about medication-assisted recovery, and one of the ways in which the FDA is looking at this idea of abstinence being the only goal of treatment is that that is greatly limiting in terms of possible medications to help people with their recovery. So the FDA has drafted new guidelines as of February 12, 2015, for drug companies, pharmaceutical companies, interested in developing alcoholism treatment. According to this spokesperson, Eric Pahan, he made a comment to Bloomberg Business. He said that abstinence-based endpoints have often been considered an unattainable threshold in the clinical setting and may be considered a hindrance to clinical development of drugs to treat alcoholism. While total abstinence from alcohol is desirable, heavy drinking, reduced to low-risk drinking, presents an alternative goal in drug treatment development so that more treatments may be developed. Now, we know that, for example, for alcohol, we have seen some medications to help. The oldest is probably antabuse. This is a medication that, when you take it, blocks enzymes in your liver and doesn't allow the alcohol to be detoxified through the liver in the normal pathway. And it stops at a point at which the substance is now similar to formaldehyde, and it makes a person violently ill. They can actually, it can be life-threatening if they drink too much on antabuse. So that was probably the first medication that we used to intervene. The next for alcohol, we use something called naltrexone. You've heard of naloxone, which is a reversal agent for opiate overdose. So if you had a heroin overdose and you went to the emergency room, the doctors or nurses there would give you an injection of something called Narcan or naloxone, which would immediately kick all the substances, all the opiates off of your opiate receptors and leave you no longer in respiratory depression or at death's doorstep, but certainly leave you in a situation of immediate and intense opiate withdrawal. There are a subset of alcoholics who find alcohol to be extremely rewarding. These are individuals that have a different genetic marker than other types of alcoholics. These are often folks who are risk-seeking. They like adventure. They like adrenaline. They like high drama. And they find that not only are they getting the dopamine, our pleasure chemical, and some GABA, which is that relax you and make you feel calm, but they also, in this particular group, have activity at the opiate receptors. And so part of the pleasure that they get from using alcohol is related to the opiate receptors. So if you give these this group of alcoholics naltrexone, which is a longer-acting form of Narcan, if you give them this once a day by mouth dose, they find that they don't get the same buzz or reward from alcohol. Now, they still can get intoxicated, and they can still drink. It doesn't make them sick, but the reward is gone. And so for many people, they will find that they really don't find alcohol that interesting or rewarding, and it will decrease their use. And in some countries, this is a primary treatment. They will actually have the patient continue to drink while taking naloxone, and the person will gradually drink less and less and less because they're getting less and less of a reward from it, and they stop drinking. Here in the United States, we use it primarily to help people with cravings. It settles down and occupies those opiate receptors, so they're not looking around for something to make them activate, and it decreases, for this particular population, not for everyone, it decreases their desire. We have another medication called Campril, which works on GABA glutamate and seems to be very helpful for a number of my patients, including women, seem to respond very well. Folks who are more likely to use alcohol to mood alter in the sense of making the situation less painful, folks who have used in isolation, used at their home by themselves, they often respond to Campril. Sometimes we will give a combination of naltrexone and Campril, and this seems to be very helpful for some patients. New to the game, although not a new medication, is a anticonvulsant called gabapentin. This was originally used to treat epilepsy. Many of you may be familiar with the brand name, which is Neurontin, used to treat nerve-related and other types of chronic pain syndromes. We have found that gabapentin can be helpful not only as a way to detoxify people off of alcohol and benzodiazepines, but also as a treatment to help stop drinking altogether, reduce the alcohol cravings, improve the person's sleep, which is a big problem for folks coming off alcohol and benzos, and also to reduce the anxiety that many of these people feel. So for patients particularly that have a lot of anxiety, the GABA in gabapentin is that neurotransmitter that calms you down, helps you relax, that alcohol and benzodiazepines, interestingly, marijuana and chocolate also release GABA, and this is part of the reward system. So the gabapentin stabilizes that without releasing the reward chemical dopamine, and patients are able to have decreased cravings, improved sleep, and decreased anxiety. A 12-week study of 150 alcohol-dependent patients were found that they at least tripled the percentage of the people who were able to stop drinking altogether compared to those who were using a placebo. So this is very good news that there are some other ways in which we may be not only measuring the success of treatment, but allowing pharmaceutical companies to have an endpoint that may be reducing cravings and reducing heavy use. We are always looking for things that can be helpful, and another, it's actually a hormone that we have found to be quite helpful, is oxytocin. Now, this is a hormone that is produced in the pituitary gland in your brain. This is known by some as the love chemical. We use it often in our patients who are having difficulty with social anxiety and feeling uncomfortable in relationships, difficulty bonding with their loved ones, and difficulty feeling comfortable enough to go to a 12-step meeting, to go to church, to go to other places where they may find some help and support. So this is an important breakthrough, but there was a recent article that just talked about the use of oxytocin actually in terms of helping reduce cravings, particularly for alcohol. So not only is it making the person feel more comfortable and more connected to people, having less negative self-talk in the back of their head, that negative critical voice that is often shaming and gets in the way of people being able to do the healthy things that they should do for themselves. But oxytocin actually can help reduce cravings and amplifies the reinforcing properties of social engagement. So this is really important when you think about, we're asking patients to give up substances and behaviors that release large amounts of dopamine, this very potent reward chemical that will really cause people to go to great lengths to be able to continue to receive that. We take that away by eliminating their use of drugs and alcohol, and the problem that we see is that now, unfortunately, there is little in their life that seems happy or that seems to be important, and more discouragement, more guilt and shame. So if we can increase this opportunity for patients to feel more connected and to feel more reward from doing things in everyday life, enjoying the beauty of the day, the pleasure of seeing their child smile, looking at ways in which we can improve their connection with their world and their relationships, and also find a way to help increase their satisfaction in their life. They're missing something that gives them a pleasure that they can't really find in real life. So we need to help them find other ways in which they can get pleasure. And the use of oxytocin may be just the thing. We're seeing some real considerable improvement in patients' reports of feeling more comfortable in their skin, the decrease of negative self-chatter so that they can engage in a 12-step meeting, decrease social anxiety so that they feel more comfortable speaking out in a process group or sharing at a 12-step meeting. These are the things that can really make a difference for people in terms of being able to maintain long-term sobriety. If life is still gray, if you're still depressed and anxious and full of shame and guilt, it's pretty hard to feel like you are making progress and that the sacrifices that you're making are worth the effort. So oxytocin may be something that provides a real boost to people in their recovery efforts. We're going to take a break now. When we come back, we're going to talk about some other ways in which changing your brain may be able to change your recovery. I'm Dr. Susan Blank. Thanks for listening.
The disease of addiction is a life-altering challenge, not just for the person suffering its effects, but also for the family and friends who support and love the one caught in its grasp. What should be the course of treatment? Who is the best person to render treatment? And what is the best place to go for the care that is needed? We know that you want answers to these and many more questions. Call 770-696-9862 and speak to a representative of the Atlanta Healing Center. They can tailor a program specifically designed to address the needs of the person suffering with an addiction or give you guidance as to where that help may be found. Information is the key, and the trained staff at AHC is here to assist. If you wish, you can also get more information on the website located at www.atlantahealingcenter.com.
This is Tracy Pearson with Prissy Tomboy. Listen to the Prissy Tomboy radio show every Tuesday at 5 p.m. Eastern Time as I interview special guests that will inspire adventure and fitness for females.
Did you miss a show that you really wanted to hear? All of our programs are available for download on AmericasWebRadio.com and on iTunes. You can listen to your favorite programs on AmericasWebRadio.com anytime you like.
Perhaps you are struggling to cope with the disease of addiction. If not, you probably know a family member or friend that needs help in battling the cravings and the personal and professional damage done by the effects of drugs or alcohol. Get a pen and paper and be ready to write down the following. These are the issues that the trained staff at the Atlanta Healing Center address and treat every day. Their doctors and counselors with over 40 years of practice in the field of addiction can treat the suffering individual in a thoughtful, compassionate, and experienced manner and guide him or her along the path to recovery. So call 770-696-9862 and speak to a knowledgeable staff member about how you or your loved one can be helped to enjoy a better and healthier life. More information is also available on the website at www.atlantahealingcenter.com.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Welcome back. I'm Dr. Susan Blank. This is Detailing Addiction. I'm broadcasting from the Atlanta Healing Center. And again, I invite you to check out our new website at www.atlantahealingcenter.com. One of the things to look for is the tab for the Atlanta Wellness Center. We have gotten many requests over the years for treatment of loved ones, folks who have children, spouses, parents with the disease of addiction. The opportunity for the person who we call the family member, the loved one, to have problems with insomnia, with stress, with hormone imbalance, with nutritional deficits, with cognitive problems is very real. Codependency also creates physical, emotional, and spiritual changes in a person. And the Atlanta Wellness Center is a part of our program that allows us to provide services for people who don't have the disease of addiction or don't have a psychiatric diagnosis, but still want to take advantage of some of the hormonal testing, nutritional testing, neurofeedback, which we're going to talk about next, some of these other services, acupuncture, that can help them manage stress and improve their peak performance, if you will. So check out the Atlanta Wellness tab on the Atlanta Healing Center tab or website. So last but not least, in terms of new innovations regarding the treatment of addiction, comes from something that I found very interesting in James Clear's book called Habit Stacking. It's S.J. Scott's book called Habit Stacking. I got the names wrong. Forgive me. This book talks about how to build new habits by taking advantage of old ones. Now, that may sound strange, but one of the things that we often have to talk about with both our patients and their family members in terms of their recovery is that they've got to build new habits. They've got to spend their time, their energy, their money, their focus on different things. And if you're the codependent, you've got to stop trying to control everybody and everything and spending all the time worrying about others and not taking good care of yourself. And for the person who has the disease of addiction, they've got to stop all of the addictive behaviors and substances and learn to live life, as we say, on life's terms, and learn new coping skills that will help them manage their life and help them stay healthy and strong. So this particular book is intriguing, and one of the things to understand is that at Oxford University in 2007, they did a study looking at the brains of newborn babies. And what they realized when they compared the number of neurons, the brain cells, if you will, the average adult has 41% fewer brain cells or neurons than does the average newborn baby. Now, that doesn't make sense. How can a baby have more brain cells, and yet we as adults are able to do many more things? We have more skills. We can stand up and walk and jump and talk and work and perform duties and have fun. Babies can do little to none of those things under their own steam. So how is it that they have so many more neurons? Well, this comes about in terms of what we call synaptic pruning. So the synapses are the linkages that are made between the different cells. At the end of the cells are these little tentacles, if you will, called synapses. And these connections connect with other cells, connect with other networks to help a person perform a skill, to speak, to stand, to fall asleep, to do all kinds of things. These neural networks are very, very important. And as we begin to learn a skill set, then as we say, those neurons that fire together wire together. We see increase in the strength of these neural networks, in the strength of these synapses, and other areas that are not so important don't get used, and so they tend to not be built up. Now, part of this is the idea that as you began to practice a skill. Say you started playing tennis when you were five and you practiced every day and you worked with a coach and you played on the tennis team. Your skill set in terms of being able to play tennis successfully increases every time you practice. And those neurons that are responsible for your hand-eye coordination and your balance and your ability to move with agility and speed around the tennis court get better and better the more you practice. Those neurons that are responsible for allowing you to do that become stronger and stronger in their connections. When we think about the way in which people begin to use drugs and alcohol, there are rituals that occur. The way the person prepares the substance or prepares the addictive behavior and begins to be engaged in it, all of these things become part of the reinforcement and the strength of the desire to continue to do that. And the more you do it, the more skilled you are at figuring out the titration of your dose and how to deliver it and when is too much and when is not enough. And your body and your brain begins to hardwire these neural networks. So as we grow and develop, neural networks that, you know, as a baby, you have lots of possibilities. As an adult, and as you age, you get more specific about the things that you do every day and the habits that you build. So one of the things that happens is you get this pruning. Things that are not important, skills that you don't really need or use, go away. And the strong networks based around your habits continue. So when we're talking about both for the person with the disease of addiction and for their loved ones, the way in which you can improve your new skill set in terms of self-care and modulation of behaviors is to stack habits onto habits that you already have. So, for example, if every morning I get up and I brush my teeth, I have hardwired that for years and years and years. I don't have to think about it. I don't have to wonder. I don't have to plan. I just have to do it. So if I can link, okay, I need to take my medication for my thyroid and my anti-craving medication, I'm going to stack that new behavior on an old behavior. So I will associate, I brush my teeth, I take my medications, I make my commitment to recovery. Before I eat my first bite of dinner, I'm going to review the day and say one thing I'm thankful for. I'm not going to forget to eat dinner. I'm not going to forget to pick up my fork, but I can now stack a new habit of gratitude and thankfulness. I can add meditation that while I brew my morning coffee, I don't drink coffee, but let's have that supposition, I'll meditate for a minute. New habits can be learned and become hardwired with old habits that are there. And if we neglect the problematic old behaviors and habits, then our synaptic pruning will occur, and those will become less and less ingrained, less and less of a temptation, less and less of problems for us, because we're ignoring those and we're building new habits on top of our old habits. So use your current habits that you do every day. We do this with our neurofeedback as well. We're retraining the brain to think and operate in a way that is more efficient, more effective, and symptom reducing. This helps the patient learn to be able to have more flexibility with their brain, improve thinking speed and process, improve memory and concentration, decrease anxiety, improve sleep, improve performance in so many ways. And the direct feedback that your brain gets from watching the movie helps you to begin to develop these new neural networks that will help you be much more successful in your recovery. I'm Dr. Susan Blank. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you next week on Detailing Addiction.
This is America's Webradio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.